ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
There are already a large number of tasks for which AI agents are more competent than most workers.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
The US president has launched a spray on social media, calling out Australia and several other allies for their lack of assistance in the Middle East. Shadow Minister for Sovereign Capability Andrew Hastie described the move as a petulant post from a president under immense pressure, while former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said the post came straight from the heart. It comes as the Treasurer reiterated he wasn't aware of any formal requests for naval assistance in the Strait of Hormuz. And the fallout from the RBA's interest rate hike is continuing to reverberate. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm David Spears.
And David, we'll come to the fallout from the RBA's interest rate increase in a moment. But first, another day, another Donald Trump Truth Social spray. This one very much puts us in the line of fire as well. Not just us, though, to be fair, but we're there. Okay, so it all centres around whether we wanted to go and help them or not help them? Was there a formal request? Clearly, we're recording this. The Prime Minister's likely to possibly say something about whether how formal that request was for us to send a ship. But are we in trouble with him?
As far as I'm told, within government PK, there was no formal request. There was no informal request either. Yes, there were conversations with the Americans about helping the UAE, and we've done that with the Wedgetail surveillance aircraft, but there was no conversation about ships in patrolling the Strait of Hormuz. I know we can't jump up and down about every Trump post, but I do think
we can, but we don't want to.
That's true. I do think this really matters where we've got to as of today. Maybe it's just worth stepping through what's happened here. Donald Trump decides to start a war against Iran with Israel without giving allies like Australia any heads up, any notification. Mm. Australia politely says, that's fine, we support what you're doing, delicately dances around the...
We can see the regime is bad.
Terrible regime, nuclear.
Try and do your best work.
Dances around the international law, questions, delicately, politely, doesn't hop into Trump over that. Then provides this surveillance aircraft to help the UAE.
No, only the UAE.
Only the UAE.
Not offensive. It's defensive.
Again, it doesn't publicly criticise Trump as things get worse and worse in the Strait of Hormuz. As that shut down, oil prices go through the roof. Motorists here and around the world are going crazy about the prices they're paying at the pump. Regional petrol stations running out. Still no, public criticism of Donald Trump at all. All very polite from the Australian government. Trump then has a go at Australia and others for not sending ships to patrol the strait when it didn't even ask Australia to send ships to patrol the strait. And what's more, PK, the US itself seems unwilling to send its own ships to patrol the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, if this was so easy to do, why isn't the US doing this already? It's very, very dangerous. These ships are very, very vulnerable. This is not easy. Andrew Hastie this morning, I thought, said out loud on Radio National what surely everyone on both sides of politics are thinking privately. What Trump has done is disrespectful. It's a reflection on Trump's character, he said. It's petulant. And Trump clearly does not have a plan for what to do here. I think this is, look, as a side note, what makes Andrew Hastie so interesting as a politician. He says what he thinks. He doesn't just stick to talking points. It's why he cuts through. And I mean, he has a point about what Trump's done here.
You're right. And the other reason it makes him so interesting, and now I'm going into the analysis of Andrew Hastie, just give me a moment, and then we'll go back to the substantive, but is that he's a sort of a right-wing populist, and you would think coded MAGA, but he's not. He's adjacent to that. Mm. He's coded maybe the Australian version of MAGA. Australia has to be first, not America. Do you know what I mean? Like he's coded it very, very carefully, which is, no, I'm not that version of MAGA. it's about Australia first, and that's really what he's saying. Don't mess with our country. And I think that really resonates and actually makes him sort of the front runner of the populist movement.
Well, this moment suits that sort of sentiment, that Andrew Hastie sentiment about more self-sufficiency in Australia, the Matt Canavan sentiment as well, and in fairness, some of the Albanese government's future made in Australia sentiment too. Not so much the free market, small government, liberal approach, but this reminder that we are in such a volatile global environment. Have we really learnt the lessons of the pandemic? Do we need to be more self-reliant? Do we need to have a national conversation that we probably did have a bit of after COVID but haven't really resolved? What sectors do we need to be more self-reliant in, self-sufficient in? What's that going to cost? Mm-hmm. PK, none of this is cost-free. Some of it is enormously expensive. But these shocks keep coming, and this one right now is really biting.
Now, in terms of the way different people in the political scene have responded, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, as I said, not a fan, of course, of Donald Trump, but Turnbull has said the remarks came straight from the heart, reinforced the need for us to build what he says is this kind of independent sovereignty. So you hear that from his perspective, Hastie's perspective, as you say. Anthony Albanese is going to enter this space as well. He's about to give a speech, which I think is significant, where he talks about we need a new economic model. Now, why would you be talking about a new economic model? That's the sovereignty language. So it is basically the trendy thing at the moment, wouldn't you say? It's like, it's the vibe at the moment. And they're all going to pitch it in their own unique way, Labor in a very Labor way. And Labor hopes to be able to make it more than rhetoric as well. They're in government. So they can. It can be more than just sloganeering.
I think Labor's approach to this, and not as a criticism so much, has been on future energy needs and what we can do, whether it's in critical minerals. Remember, there was also a bit of money for making solar panels in Australia. I'm not sure how far that's progressed, but it was all about the renewable future and the role that Australia can play in getting those industries off the ground here. It's not so much those old industries like oil refining, right, that Labor's been focused on. But it's very much what Andrew Hastie's now focused on, what Matt Canavan's focused on. We are going to have a think about the sort of industries we still rely on. And, boy, are we discovering that right now.
So are we going to refine oil?
We do refine some oil, don't we, PK?
But I mean more.
Are we? Well, it would require what? The government to get involved in directly owning or working with a private operator to get one of those other refineries back up and running. You'd still need to get the oil coming in, though, to refine it. Mm. I think, as Angus Taylor talked about, maybe drilling.
Drill baby drill
for oil here. I don't know how viable that is. And I think most of those old refineries are mainly being used for import terminals right now anyway. So, look, I don't know technically how doable it is, but maybe the government does need to be thinking about, and I know Jacob was talking about this on the pod yesterday or the day before, what it can be doing about using its balance
buying
sheet to
power.
Buying international fuel somehow.
At perhaps extremely high rates. Yeah. To just keep the stockpile up because we've just dipped into it, right?
Tomorrow the National Cabinet will meet.
What are they doing? What's the purpose
of that? I think, I don't know this, but that would be the forum where you would talk about fuel rationing because you'd need the states to be involved in any move. Now, I don't know whether that's where they're going.
Well, they're saying, okay, all the key players are saying we're not at the rationing point yet. But I think that, I noticed that. I'm like, oh. So we're going to get to the point?
Because you'd need to have the states involved in working out how to do that. Look, I don't know whether that's where they're going to go, but the sort of options that would have to be on the table are rationing, purchasing, taking control of distribution to make sure it is getting to where it's needed in the regions and the various primary industries that need the fuel to keep operating and keep everything moving in the economy. So bottom line, is there any sense that Trump has found a way to end this, to get the oil flowing through the Strait of Hormuz and fix this problem? I don't see it.
No, but is he now creating the preconditions for pullout? That's the question.
I mean, maybe.
Well, he's
maybe
talked about,
and blame the allies.
And also they've got all of the key players is what they're saying.
I was talking to someone senior in the Australian government here. It was anticipating this, right, that Trump sooner rather than later calls it quits and says we've achieved, you know, all this, weakened the Iranian regime. True, and they'd be able to bank that and say, look, we've really depleted their ability to make missiles, fire missiles. The regime, we've knocked off the, you know, so many of their top people. But the regime is still there. The enriched uranium is still there. What is it, 400 kilograms, mm-hmm. that's close to weapons grade. They still haven't got that. That's going to require ground troops if they want to get that. Mm-hmm. They're still able to open and close the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, that would see the US walking away. Trump can say what he wants, but it would see the US walking away from this pretty humiliated, I would have thought.
Well, he'll argue that they're not humiliated, and MAGA will go into full force arguing that's, you know, because actually there's been a big debate in the US. We're going to pivot out of this in a second, but just there's been a big debate in the US about whether MAGA has turned on him or not. And I don't think they really have.
No,
yet.
I mean, there's like the Joe Rogans had a go.
Yeah.
Tucker Carlson's had a go.
That matters. But you expect those to still, if you look at all the polling in terms
I did see some polling that had Republican support still right up there for what Trump's doing. Mm. I don't know how long that lasts, right? Obviously, the fuel and inflation bite will eat into that, you would think. But right now, yeah, I think it's holding.
Okay, and that brings me to our own domestic situation. And there was a poll out the other day showing that Australians blame the government, not the Middle East crisis, for the problems they're seeing. And that shows that the woes that the federal government has and will only get worse are actually building. So what are the facts around this? Well, the fuel crisis is worsening, and we know that, and we just talked about that. Yesterday we spoke to Carrington on the pod, you can still listen to it, about the fact that the RBA has made a decision to increase interest rates. That wasn't unanimous. Now there's a lot of discussion about whether we go into a recession or not. I think Jim Chalmers has said, no, I don't think we're going to. Well, you know, he doesn't anticipate it, the sort of language.
So
there.
The Michelle Bullock line yesterday was a pretty powerful one. We don't want to have a recession, she said, but if it's hard to get inflation down, then, you know, we're going to have to deal with that possibility. Mm. It felt like a version of a recession that we might have to have. Okay, to borrow a phrase, to get inflation down. Jim Chalmers this morning, you know, he did the rounds of media interviews and obviously got asked this question a lot. He said a recession's not something the government's expecting, forecasting, or anticipating. He can't rule it out, but he can certainly send every signal that, no, this is not on the cards and we're going to work hard to avoid that happening. But the other, I mean, two things jumped out for me from what the Treasurer was saying this morning. Again, this was on Radio National. The key uncertainty is how long this thing drags out for, he said. So he's really highlighting just how uncertain the future is on this front. The second thing he said, the assumption that if the war ended tomorrow, that the global economy would be fine the day after is a naive one, Jim Chalmers said. So he's flagging there that even if Trump magically ends this in the next week or so, it doesn't mean the economy snaps back.
No, he's absolutely right on all precedents, right? Yep. So he's right there. So it brings you to one contradictory statement that I think he's been making that I just want to explore, and I think that actually the opposition's getting a bit of traction on this and will if they, you know, consistently hammer it, which is he was at pains, put it in his statement, said it 300 times, that the RBA has not said it's government spending that's the problem. Mm. This is very important, of course, for him because one of the biggest criticisms of the federal government is that they're spending too much and that they are contributing to inflation, even being responsible for it, even the opposition clearly claims. So he wants that to be destroyed as an argument. But at the same time, David, and Tim Wilson made this point, and I thought quite eloquently on my show yesterday in Afternoon Briefing, he said, well, you can't say government spending is not contributing and then equally say, oh, yeah, no, we're working on these budget cuts. So why would you think that was so necessary, which he clearly is highlighting, and they're trying to butter us up for not only budget cuts but big tax changes, which we'll get to in a minute, with housing taxes and various other things, if it wasn't a problem. I do think there's a little bit of a confusion around those things. I can't see how these two sentences work together.
No, look, it's a fair point that if you don't think there's a problem, you wouldn't be hacking into government spending.
So you must know that it's not ideal, the rate of spending.
It's a delicate one. It's a delicate one because...
Can't have it both ways.
No, clearly the government does need to do what it can.
I get he's technically right about the Reserve Bank citing it, technically correct, but that's not the broader question. The question is, do we have too much money being spent by the federal government and is it contributing to some of our economic problems like this inflation that is so hardwired into our system now that we may need to go into a recession, according to the RBA, which none of us want to go into. I mean, I'm sure you and I are not
100%
because we're old and we remember recessions and we don't like them.
And that's a whole other set of economic political problems for the government. I mean, interest rates, we know for the last term and now this one has been such a political headache, but a recession, that's a whole different ballgame too, because that's where you're talking about the unemployment rate starting to go up. You're talking about the story shifting to people losing their jobs. That becomes, particularly for a Labor government, incredibly difficult. So this budget won't be easy. I know everyone talks about this budget being the hardest budget. I think it will be, not only because things are moving around so fast. You're trying to settle a budget when the ground beneath you is shifting around rapidly. But you're also having to try and fend off a recession while at the same time reining in spending. I don't know how you do that. It's not going to be easy.
No, I definitely don't want to be the treasurer today. I won't lie. Let's go to some of the reforms they're looking at. The Greens-led Senate inquiry on capital gains tax was handed down yesterday, so we're recording this Wednesday. On Tuesday it came out. Labor senators sided with the Greens in this finding, and I'm quoting, "The capital gains tax discount in combination with negative gearing have skewed the ownership of housing away from owner-occupiers and towards investors." Okay, that's a statement of perhaps the bleeding obvious based
for Labor,
on...
For Labor, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, right? But they're trying to build the case now for changing it. If you heard the Treasurer this morning, and he's done lots of interviews and he's speaking to me later again, he wants you to know that they're working on this so there's no surprises. It seems to me a fait accompli, isn't it?
I think it certainly sounds like it. I think the real debate now is what shape the changes form. So is it going to be grandfathering existing investments or not? If you're going to hit existing investments, you're going to be able to raise a lot more money that could then be used for a personal income tax cut, you know, which could sweeten the deal here, helping workers. Similarly with negative gearing, where are you going to draw the line on how many properties you can negatively gear, or, you know, for how long, or what the various ways you can. I think that's where the debate is about the shape of these changes. It seems very clear these changes are coming in some form, but how big they are, I think that the hints the Treasurer has been dropping have been fascinating. And over the weekend on Sky News, when he was talking about this current international crisis, making it clear to him that they need to go further, not slower, on reform, I thought that was quite telling as well, that he, and I don't know if this is a cabinet-wide sentiment, but the Treasurer is leaning in more strongly to the need for bolder reform because of what's going on internationally, as he should be, frankly. I mean, this, I think, gives a political reason for reform in the minds of voters who are seeing what's going on and may well be more open to the need for serious change, but also, you know, from a productivity sense. We've talked about productivity for how long, Pika?
Oh, no, I don't know. I'm going to fall into a coma.
We need some tax reform here.
Yeah, we do. And the government's conceded we need tax reform. But when you talk about the Treasurer, you know, he's leaning more and more. Well, he's been leaning for as long as before any crisis, in the crisis, after the crisis, before the last crisis. It's just that he hasn't had a lot of enthusiasm from the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's Praetorian Guard, who lock in behind his political instincts, which are that you need to tread carefully on these things. So what's shifted is the conditions, and he's using them to mount his case, which seems very sensible, like that you would use, you know, you use what you've got, don't you?
Sure.
So that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
But I don't think his own views have changed that much. He's just using the circumstances to accelerate his success possibly on this.
I mean, we'll see in a couple of months once we see the colour of the budget.
I just, sorry to be rude and interrupt, but I just want to say You know, you've heard from the Liberal Party what will be clearly another, and I'm just calling it for what I think it is, scare campaign, new taxes on housing. You can hear the lines, right? They're just being practiced already. And sometimes that spooks the Prime Minister. So watch that space. Like if he thinks they're honing good lines, this is a man who's very attuned to the politics and might get nervous at the last minute. So there's that caveat. The other one is we've got the opposition now mounting the case of they just want to do all this, which is just revenue measures. Now, I think that case could be very successful if there isn't a broader tax reform package.
Yeah.
I think it went a bit without getting noticed, so I'm going to spook it. But I had Bill Shorten on Afternoon Briefing talking about an idea he had on something else, which was very interesting. But then he also talked about all these housing reforms and he said you have to give it back in tax cuts, right? So he's not the only one. Bill Keltie, former ACTU, of course, but like these Labor giants, and I think Bill Shorten can be called that, why not? You know, like obviously he's a big figure in the Labor movement, now sort of saying you have to provide it that way, which is, of course, the Legra spender model. And so if Jim Chalmers goes into this budget and loses that part of the fight, or I don't know where he's standing on that fight, but I'm saying doesn't deliver for workers, I reckon that that is where they will face a very successful scare campaign because you can't just take and not give.
Bill Shorten knows this better than anyone. The tax changes that he took to the election in 2019 without giving them back in the form of income tax cuts, yeah, it was the sharp lesson, and I think he's made that clear since then that whatever you do, if you're going to go back to the well on negative gearing, capital gains tax, you've got to hand that back in income tax cuts. And I think that that sentiment is broadly shared across the caucus. So, you know, I would be amazed if they're not all of a similar mind that whatever they're doing here needs to be funneled back in terms of income tax cuts. And look, there's the productivity argument for it, as Allegra Spender and others have made, that that's, you know, that's an important productivity measure. I think the government would also be hopeful that the initial sort of reaction to the kite flying on capital gains tax has been pretty positive in the financial press, which are often quite critical of this government, but from the likes of Ken Henry, Allegra Spender and so on. The ground has been tilled, I think.
Yeah.
It's open to the government to go there.
And it's very similar, I've said this before, but just to mention, to the model for when they changed the Stage 3 tax cuts. They've now so far followed a very similar kind of script where you get the people ready, where everyone else has made the case. And if it does end up happening, and it looks likely, but we'll see, you're going to have to, you know, take your hat off to Allegra Spender and others who've done that, Grattan Institute, everyone who's done the heavy lifting for a long time to mount this case.
And where does it leave the Liberals?
Oh, that's why I mentioned the if you don't do the other part of it, it leaves the Liberals with a campaign that can really run. If it's a fulsome package that actually does deal with some of the sort of structural issues around work being of value, like you just, you're a PAYG tax earner and you keep paying more tax and then the big guys are paying less, you know, by proportion than you, that, that makes you pretty cranky as you can't get ahead in this economy. People feel really, really disgruntled that they can't get ahead. If you look at some of the people who are doing these gig economy jobs, these are their second jobs just to afford their lives. They're not, you know, this isn't sort of a uni student on their weekend. This is like just, this is a dad and mum doing second jobs
trying
to stay ahead.
And this is where the political wedge will be attractive for the Prime Minister, I would assume, if he can pit working families.
Well, I'd be doing that. I'd be doing that. And I'd be second. We'll see what the package is. Obviously, there's a lot of caveats and detail. But I'd be very concerned if I was the opposition campaigning against something that actually substantially puts workers ahead, if that is to happen. And, of course, there's a lot of ifs there. David, any final thoughts from you?
Look, I just think this National Cabinet meeting tomorrow is going to be really interesting. I think we can talk about tax and what's coming in the budget, but the immediate concern right now for everybody is, well, the interest rate hike that's just hit, but also what is going to happen with fuel? I mean, this is such a big part of the household budget, and that the petrol price sign that you drive past every 5 minutes is such a visual reminder of this crisis that we're in. So I think that puts enormous political pressure on the government and the states to come up with further answers tomorrow.
And don't forget, just final thought from me, it's only a couple of weeks away from Easter, school holidays, that's road trip land for many families, including my own.
People would be reassessing that.
Totally. Okay, there's the supply issue, but then just the cost if you can get the supply in your own city and you can. Yeah, absolutely. So if you're talking about like opinion polls and how people feel about governments, if you're thinking twice about your trip interstate or, you know, to the country or wherever you're doing because you can't afford your petrol or you think, you know, it's going to take you over the line, come on, that's going to make you pretty grumpy. That's going to have ramifications. David. It's my Schitt's Creek joke every time. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
every time.
See you later.
A repeat offender. Thank you, David. Fran and I will be joined by ABC Chief Election Analyst Casey Briggs on the Party Room tomorrow. He's knee deep in all things South Australian election. Of course, that's our weekend watching. And he'll tease out what the data is saying and talk about other things too. Don't you worry. Send questions to the Party Room at abc.net.au. See ya.